From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Passer by Robert W. Chambers. When he had finished his pipe, he tapped the briar bowl against the chimney until the ashes powdered the charred log smoldering across the andrens. Then he sat back in his chair, absently touched the hot pipe bowl with the tip of each finger until it grew cool enough to be dropped into his coat pocket. Twice he raised his eyes to the little American clock ticking upon the mantel. He had half an hour to wait. The three candles that lighted the room might be trimmed to advantage. This would give him something to do. A pair of scissors lay open upon the bureau, and he rose and picked them up. For a while he stood dreamily shutting and opening the scissors, his eyes roaming about the room. There was an easel in the corner and a pile of dusty canvases behind it. Behind the canvases there was a shadow, that gray, menacing shadow that never moved. When he had trimmed each candle, he wiped the smoky scissors on a paint rag and flung them on the bureau again. The clock pointed to 10. He had been occupied exactly 3 minutes. The bureau was littered with neckties, pipes, combs, and brushes, matches, reels, and fly books, collars, shirt studs, a new pair of Scotch shooting stockings, and a woman's work basket. He picked out all the neckties, folded them once, and hung them over a bit of twine that stretched across the looking glass. The shirt studs he shoveled into the top drawer, along with brushes, combs, and stockings. The reels and fly books he dusted with his handkerchief and placed methodically along the mantel shelf. Twice he stretched out his hand towards the woman's work basket, but his hand fell to his side again, and he turned away into the room, staring at the dying fire. Outside the snow-sealed window, a shutter broke loose and banged monotonously until he flung open the panes and fastened it. The soft, wet snow that had choked the window panes all day was frozen hard now, and he had to break the polished crust before he could find the rusty shutter hinge. He leaned out for a moment, his numbed hands resting on the snow, the roar of a rising snow squall in his ears, and out across the desolate garden and stark hedgerow, he saw the flat, black river spreading through the gloom. A candle sputtered and snapped behind him. A sheet of drawing paper fluttered across the floor, and he closed the panes and turned back into the room, both hands in his worn pockets. The little American clock on the mantel ticked and ticked, but the hands lagged, for he had not been occupied 5 minutes in all. He went up to the mantel and watched the hands of the clock. A minute, longer than a year to him, crept by. Around the room the furniture stood ranged, a chair or two of yellow pine, a table, the easel, and in one corner the broad curtain bed, and behind each lay shadows, menacing shadows that never moved. A little pale flame started up from the smoking log on the andrens. The room sang with the sudden hiss of escaping wood gases. After a little, the back of the log caught fire. Jets of blue flared up here and there with mellow sounds, like the lighting of gas burners in a row, and in a moment a thin sheet of yellow flame wrapped the whole charred log. Then the shadows moved. Not the shadows behind the furniture, they never moved, but other shadows, thin, gray, confusing, that came and spread their slim patterns all around him and trembled and trembled. He dared not step or tread upon them. They were too real. They meshed the floor round his feet. They ensnared his knees. They fell across his breast like ropes. Some night in the silence of the moors, when wind and river were still, he feared these strands of shadow might tighten, creep higher around his throat and tighten. But even then he knew that those other shadows would never move, those gray shapes that knelt crouching in every corner. When he looked up at the clock again, 10 minutes had struggled past. Time was disturbed in the room. The strands of shadow seemed entangled among the hands of the clock, dragging them back from their rotation. He wondered if the shadows would strangle. Time, some still night when the wind and the flat river were silent. There grew a sudden chill across the floor. The cracks of the boards let it in. He leaned down and drew his sabots towards him from their place near the andrens and slipped them over his chaussons, and as he straightened up, his eyes mechanically sought the mantle above, where in the dusky another pair of sabots stood, little, slender, delicate sabots, carved from red beech. A year's dust grayed their surface. A year's rust dulled a silver hand across the instep. He said this to himself aloud, knowing that it was within a few minutes of the year. His own sabots came from Mordieu. They were shaved square and banded with steel, but in days past he had thought that no sabot in Mordieu was delicate enough to touch the instep of the Mordieu pêcheur. So he sent to the shore lighthouse, and they sent to Lorient, where the women are coquettish and show their hair under the coif, and wear dainty sabots, and in this town, where vanity corrupts, and there is much lace on coif and collarette, a pair of delicate sabots was found, banded with silver and chiseled in red beech. The sabot stood on the mantel above the spire now, dusty and tarnished. There was a sound from the window, the soft murmur of snow blotting glass panes. The wind too muttered under the eaves. Presently, it would begin to whisper to him from the chimney. He knew it, and he held his hands over his ears and stared at the clock. In the hamlet of Mordieu, the panes sing all day of the sea secrets, but in the night the ghosts of little gray birds fill the branches, singing of the sunshine of past years. He heard the song as he sat, and he crushed his hands over his ears, but the gray birds joined with the wind in the chimney, and he heard all that he dared not hear, and he thought all that he dared not hope or think, and the swift tears scalded at his eyes. In Mordieu the nights are longer than anywhere on earth. He knew it. Why should he not know? This had been so far a year. It was different before. There were so many things different before. Days and nights vanished like minutes then. The pines told no secrets of the sea, and the gray birds had not yet come to Mordieu. Also, there was Jean, pêcheur at the Carmes. When he first saw her, she was pulling the square, flat-bottomed ferry skiff from the Carmes to Mordieu, a red skirt fluttering just below her knees. The next time he saw her, he had to call to her across the placid river. "Ohé, ohé, pêcheur!" She came pulling the flat skiff, her deep blue eyes fixed pensively on him, the scarlet skirt and kerchief idly flapping in the April wind. Then day followed day, when the far call, "Pêcheur!" grew clearer and more joyous, and the faint answering cry, "I come," rippled across the water, like music tinged with laughter. Then spring came, and with spring came love. Love, carried free across the ferry from the Carmes to Mordieu. The flames above the charring log whistled, flickered, and went out in a jet of wood vapor, only to play like lightning above the gas and relight again. The clock ticked more loudly, and the song from the pines filled the room. But in his straining eyes a summer landscape was reflected, where white clouds sailed and white foam curled under the square bow of a little skiff. And he pressed his numb hands tighter to his ears to drown the cry, "Passeur, passeur." And now for a moment the clock ceased ticking. It was time to go. Who but he would know it? He who went out into the night, swinging his lantern. And he went. He had gone each night from the first, from that first strange winter evening when a strange voice answered him across the river. The voice of the new passer. He had never heard her voice again. So he passed down the windy wooden stairs, lantern hanging lighted in his hand, and stepped out into the storm. Through sheets of drifting snow, over heaps of frozen seaweed and icy drift, he moved, shifting his lantern right and left, until its glimmer on the water warned him. Then he called out into the night, "Passeur!" The frozen spray spattered his face and crusted the lantern. He heard the distant boom of breakers beyond the bar and the noise of mighty winds among the seaward skiff. "Passeur!" Across the broad, flat river, black as a sea of pitch, a tiny light sparked a moment. Again he cried, "Passeur!" "I come." He turned ghastly white, for it was her voice, or was he crazy? And he sprang waist-deep into the icy current and cried out again, but his voice ended in a sob. Slowly through the snow the flat skiff took shape, creeping nearer and nearer. But she was not at the pole. He saw that. There was a tall, thin man, shrouded to the eyes in oilskin, and he leaped into the boat and bade the ferryman hasten. Halfway across, he rose in the skiff and called, "Jean!" But the roar of the storm and the thrashing of the icy waves drowned his voice. Yet he heard her again, and she called to him by name. When at last the boat grated upon the invisible shore, he lifted his lantern, trembling, stumbling among the rocks, and calling to her, as though his voice could silence the voice that had spoken a year ago that night, and it could not. He sank shivering upon his knees and looked out into the darkness, where an ocean rolled across a world. Then his stiff lips moved, and he repeated her name. But the hand of the fair man fell gently upon his head, and when he raised his eyes, he saw that the ferryman was Death.